Thank you all for coming tonight. This is the last talk for me here in my stay in Beijing, and I want to thank you for being such a good host and for hosting me on my first trip to China. I never thought that I would get to come to China in this fashion, speaking to young journalists like yourself. It's been a real honor and a treat for me, and I thank you very much for listening. Thank you. So when they asked me to talk tonight, they said the topic should be on international reporting as a photojournalist. And that's part of what I do. I was thinking, what is the most useful thing I could talk to you guys about? Because I want to make this as useful a presentation as possible. And I want to leave lots of time at the end so that you can ask me the kind of questions that will be helpful for you. I want to know what I can tell you to help you along on your way to becoming wonderful journalists yourself. So when I was thinking about what to talk about tonight, I thought about what is the most important part of what we do as journalists? What is the essence of what we do? Every story that I work on, whether it's about politics or the environment, whether it's about war or famine or a profile, everything we do, when it comes down to it, is about people. And it's about how these stories affect people and how these people affect the world in which we live. As a photojournalist, every story that we tell has to be told through the eyes of these people. And I'm reminded every day when I try to do my job, and it can be a very difficult one, is that in order to do my job, I rely on a gift. And it's a gift that the people that I tell the stories about, it's a gift they have to give me every single day. And this is the gift of access. This is a gift they give me when they share their lives, they open up their homes to me, they share their laughter, their joy, sometimes they're tears. And it's a very precious gift, and I always have to remember to treat it as this precious gift. And the way to do that is to be honest and fair, to tell stories that do justice to these people's lives. I don't know if any of you have ever been on the other side. I know you're all young journalists. But if you've ever been on the other side of a reporter's notebook or a cameraman's lens, it can be a very vulnerable experience. When you talk to a reporter or when you have your picture taken, you are putting your life, your image, your story in the hands of a complete stranger and trusting that they will handle that with respect and with honor. And that is our responsibility. I like to tell this story about when I was a young photographer. Sorry, I can't decide whether I should be up here or down here. And one of my first assignments at this newspaper was to photograph a small parade. And at this parade, there was a young woman who was a beauty queen. And she's riding on top of a float, on top of a car, and she's waving to everybody. Just a young girl. But she has braces. Do you know, everybody familiar with braces, you know, to correct your teeth? They're kind of funny looking. So she's a beauty queen and has these braces. So being a young photographer, I want to show everybody how clever I can be, how smart I can be. And so I'm thinking about what shot to take, and she's coming down the street. And I look up at the top of the street, and I see a dentist office with a big sign that says orthodontics. This is the guy who makes the braces, basically. So I see this big sign that says orthodontics. And I think, this would be a very funny picture when the beauty queen comes by and I can line up her smiling face with the big braces and this sign that says orthodontics. So she comes and I take this picture and I think, oh, it's funny. And I send it into my newspaper along with a bunch of other pictures. And I sort of never really think that they're going to run this picture in the newspaper. I sent them a lot of other ones. But I pick up the newspaper the next day, and I'm a little shocked to see that picture running in the newspaper. So I felt so bad after this, because this girl also probably picked up the newspaper, as did her mother and her father, and they saw that. And she was probably so embarrassed. And I thought after that, someone should have told me, someone should have said, that's not the right thing to do. And it's not because you should be scared to take a picture that someone of someone when they're sad or at a tough time in their life, but you should always be fair. And I don't think I was being fair on that picture. And somebody should have told me about that. So I always thought after that, I'm always going to make sure that my pictures, that my camera, I don't use it like a weapon, that it's a way to tell the truth about people. It's a way to tell someone's story, and I always want to do it with respect and with dignity. So after saying that, I'm going to show you a couple stories that I've worked on. These are some stories that I've worked on at three newspapers that I've worked at, the last three newspapers, some at the New York Times, some for the Los Angeles Times, and some for the Dallas Morning News. And the first story I wanted to talk to you about is a story from Western Alaska. And it's a story about a tiny village in Western Alaska. And I apologize about the color on the projector. The photos don't look like this, but maybe you use your imagination, I guess. So it's a story about two villages in Western Alaska, very small, very remote villages, whose entire populations at one time had been sexually molested by a member of the Catholic clergy. This happened about 30 to 40 years ago when most of the people in this village were just children. So when I went to this village, this was a couple years ago, we found that this entire town had been affected by the abuse that had happened so long ago. And we found extremely high rates of domestic violence, of alcoholism, large rates of incarceration, a lot of people ending up in jail. The way we found out about it was through a lawyer who had discovered, because all of these cases were starting to come out all across the United States. This was a big church scandal that was happening all across the United States. And people in this village were watching the television, and they said, you know, this has happened to other people. Maybe it's time that we tell our stories, too. So when we arrived there in this village, some of the people, they were telling their stories for the very first time in their lives. So even though this had happened 30 or 40 years ago for many of these people, it was so fresh in their minds. This is something that they had held inside them for years, for decades, something that had eaten the insides away from them. This man, his name is John Lockwood. When I met him, I thought to myself, I've never met a person so empty inside that he looked like he was already dead, even though he was walking and he was talking and breathing. But there was nothing left to him. He was just this empty shell of a person. He hadn't been able to tell his story his whole life, not even to his wife, the closest person in the world probably to him, because they have such strong cultural norms that he was too afraid to tell his wife because he was afraid she would think he was homosexual. And this is John's children. His five kids share one tiny little room. And it's, sorry, it doesn't look blue like this, but you have to just deal with it. But you can tell he's not really there. You look at his face, he's completely absent. It's very, very sad stories. You can see how this abuse had affected them. And another person I spent a lot of time with, his name is Tommy Chimuk. And Tommy, he has two siblings. He had two brothers and a sister, and all of the brothers and sisters had been raped and molested by this deacon named Joseph Lindowski. When I spent time with him, I was always thinking about how hard it must be for this guy, Tommy, to still live in a town where such horrible things happened to him. Every day he would have to drive by the church where he was raped and molested by this deacon. And so I thought about ways to tell this story. Everywhere I went, I would see crosses like this top of a telephone pole. Even though it's not really a cross, I just started seeing them everywhere. And they became a visual metaphor for what these people had to deal with on a day-to-day basis. This is Tommy's sister, Alberta. And this is at a point where she's first admitting for the very first time that she had been raped also. And this is a very difficult picture to take. I spent a lot of time talking to people. When I first arrived in the town, I think I spent the entire first 3 or 4 days without taking a single picture. Just letting people know who we were, what the story was about, that we wanted to tell people all across the world what had happened to them in hopes that they could somehow make things better. They're a very private people. I look very different from them, as you can tell. But after a certain amount of time, they became comfortable with me. They welcomed me into their homes and allowed me, for the most part, without even, at some point they sort of stopped realizing I was there, and I became part of the landscape and was able to take a picture like this, and like some of those pictures you saw of John Lockwood, where they're very personal moments. Sorry, you can hardly even see this. This is Tommy's two children. And like I was saying, this is a moment that's so hard to capture. It doesn't really come across how difficult it is. But these are people that don't show a lot of affection towards each other in front of other people. They're very private. I spent probably a week and a half, 10 days with them. At some point, we went to a family's home, and a blizzard came. And for 10 days, I was stuck, and I lived with them. I slept on their couch. I ate all the food they ate. They like to eat a lot of whale meat, and moose, and seal. Really interesting stuff. Frozen fish. But it was only through all that time that they would ever let their guard down enough to share a moment like this, so personal, together in front of me. And I'm standing very close. I'm, you know, between here and here with them, and it's like I'm not even there. And Tommy has had a really hard time. He tried to kill himself on three different occasions. The last time was only a few weeks before I arrived in this town, St. Michael's. And the last time he tried to kill himself, he put a gun in his mouth, and just as he pulled the trigger, his wife Elsie knocked the gun out of his hand. The bullet went through the wall in the bedroom. But his brothers are not so lucky, and two of his brothers have already killed themselves. And On occasion, Tommy likes to go to the graveyard here and visit them. But his mother, Mary, still doesn't believe what happened. And she still, this is her returning from church on Sunday morning. She's still one of the very few people in the town that goes to church. And it's sort of amazing to think that all four of her children were affected by this abuse. They were all at one time raped and molested by these church officials. And as a result, two of them killed themselves. So she's lost two sons, but she still goes to church every day. And you know, when I took this picture, I'm still thinking about those crosses everywhere. And this was another victim. His name is Nick, and he had a very, very sad story. He told us the stories about what happened to him, how the abuse happened, and he would tell us these stories about how this Deacon Landowski, this Brother Joe, they called him, would keep big vats of alcohol, of wine, liquor, up in the top of the church. And when the children would come to the church, he would give them this alcohol. And his bedroom was next door to the steeple of the church. And this is where all the abuse happened. And for Nick, much of the abuse, and for the other kids too, it came in the form of oral sex. He was often forced to perform oral sex on this deacon, Brother Joe. And as a result, Nick developed this mental disorder where he believed a piece of a fishbone was stuck in his throat. And he's constantly scratching at his throat to try to get the fishbone out because he believes it's stuck there. Does this make sense to everyone? Yeah. It's a really, really sad thing. He went to several doctors. He had x-rays done. He had MRIs done because he believed so strongly. Not that this was a psychological effect from the abuse, but he believed that there was really, it was all just because there's a bone in his throat. And all he had to do was get it out and he'd be better. And so as you can imagine, church service in the towns is very quiet. Not many people still attend, but they still have church every night. And if you can imagine how cold this is, it's minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. I don't even know what that translates to in Celsius, but it's the kind of cold that if you stay out for more than a few minutes, you're in big trouble.